Dave and the Dynamos. Life begins at 40.
I think that's a perfectly good. That one is perfectly reasonably on the worst list.
Is there some truth in it, though, Michael? Life begins at 40.
I couldn't possibly comment. I don't.
You're not there yet.
No, I'm not there. No. Yes, it definitely does.
Yes, carry on.
I was going to say, somebody texted me that they'd heard on national radio earlier this morning, Chariot of Pfizer.
Yes, that's one that's got a lot of interest, hasn't it? Chariot of Pfizer. Although it's going to give Pfizer way more money than they've already got, billions and billions.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
Well, not so much money, but they're going to be more
promotion.
Promotion, yes, that's right. Ella, Life Begins at 40. What do you reckon? Worst song ever?
No, I now have categorical proof that Life Begins at 65.
Oh, excellent!
Good to hear.
A little something for you to all look forward to.
Yeah, that is good to look forward to.
Yeah, what happens at 65, Ella?
They send you a little gold card which allows you to go to Waiheke for nothing. And if you're
courtesy
Māori, people
Winston.
Start. Yes, Curtis, thank you, Winston, even though I never go to Waiheke. And should I want it, I can get cheap hearing aids. So, life is looking up.
Should you want them?
I have, Ella, I've always been surprised at how excited people that get the gold card are at the prospect of going to Waiheke for free, given that they don't normally go to Waiheke whatsoever. It does seem to me to be a disproportionately exciting thing when you don't really think you're going to use it.
Clearly that shows you how little it takes to excite you when you turn 65.
That's very reasonable. So if it had been Waiuku, it would have been just as exciting.
Exactly. There it is.
The panellists today, Dr. Ella Henry and Michael Moynihan. It's 25 minutes to 5, and for the first time since humans entered space, four people who are not trained astronauts have blasted into orbit. Elon Musk's SpaceX first private flight has been bankrolled by a 38-year-old billionaire by the name of Jared Isaacman, who's taken two sweepstake winners with him. And along for the ride is also a healthcare worker who survived childhood cancer, and Mr. Isaacman invited that person along. The adventurers will go on a 3-day round-the-world trip in a fully automated Dragon capsule, which is what SpaceX uses to send astronauts to the International Space Station for NASA. And Jared Isaacman won't say how much the trip cost him. Well, joining me now is Emmeline Part-Dahlstrom, who's the co-founder of SpaceBase. Kia ora, Emmeline.
Kia ora.
Can you just tell us, first of all, what is SpaceBase?
Yeah, well, SpaceBase is really a social enterprise here in New Zealand, and we're focused on catalyzing and growing the space industry.
Well, this flight, I guess you call it, do you call it a flight? What do you call it? In a rocket.
And it's a pretty special one because, as you mentioned, it is the very first commercial orbital space flight. And the reason for that is that the rocket is commercial, the spacecraft is commercial, and then, of course, the crew is also private citizens. No career astronauts.
Yeah, it was incredible. And it was launched our time around about midday today. It was nighttime in Florida, 8 o'clock, something like that. Incredible pictures. And it was live streamed. Did you watch it?
Yes, of course. No, it was exciting.
It must have been.
I also know one of the crew members, Sian, who was on the podcast, the Space Base podcast last year.
Oh, do you? Right. And have you been in touch leading up to the flight?
Well, I did say good luck. It's really exciting for somebody who, has spent all her life dreaming about this. And now she's flying, which is really exciting.
Which one was she? Was she the healthcare worker or one of the sweepstake winners?
She's the pilot. So the African American, CM Proctor, she's not really a winner, but she's a winner of the Shark Tank sort of competition. which is different from a lottery.
Uh-huh. And when we look at this in comparison to, say, Richard Branson or Jeff Bezos, they were accused of that not really going that far into space earlier this year, but this flight's considerably higher, isn't it?
Yeah, so the difference between the two is that those flights were only suborbital, but those are basically the one that the Bezos and Virgin was just basically a pop-up and down, while this one is an actual orbital flight. So they go up to about 585 kilometers, which is actually even a little above the International Space Station.
That's incredible. How dangerous is it? It must be quite frightening doing that.
Well, I mean, you know, this is the third flight of the Dragon, which is the SpaceX capsule that they're using. And of course, every space flight, there's always a risk. But they're definitely getting better over the years. So there is always a risk for space, but at the same time, the benefits of what you see there, and especially for people who've been wanting to go up in space, I think it's definitely an experience of a lifetime.
Yeah, well, that's really the crux of the matter, isn't it, Emmeline? And I'll just address this to Ella. It's all about commercial. It's all about, this is my, joyride, trip of a lifetime. What good is it doing to humanity, do you think, Ella, for humanity?
I do think that any opportunity to expand our capacity as a species to travel beyond our own planet is a good thing. I also, though, it may be churlish of me, but I have grave concerns about the billionaire space race, because we know the planet is facing one of the most catastrophic futures through climate change and global warming. And I just wonder if some of those worst scenario sci-fi stories are actually coming true, that they're all building, the billionaires are building somewhere that they can run away to when they finally finish destroying planet Earth and we are left with what's left. I'm sure that's just a dark dystopian, bit of paranoia, but I worry about that sometimes with this mindless race to be the first in space, being funded not by governments and not by science, but by billionaires.
Survival of the richest.
Exactly. The thick and the rich.
The thick.
Sorry, that was just me being insulting.
It's also, isn't it one of the, like a tagline for somebody like Watties? It's the Watties tomato sauce is thick and rich.
Sorry, absolutely, yes.
Well, which one are you suggesting is thick, Ella?
No, I meant, one doesn't need to be an intellectual giant to become a billionaire. But once you have that amount of financial capability, then you are able to do a lot of things that us mere mortals cannot do. And I like to think that the people who are behind the space race that are the intellectual giants of the world also have the resources to be able to do that for the betterment of all people and not just some corporate juggernaut.
What about you, Michael? Is it a new era of space flight and exploration? Do you welcome it?
Oh, look, it just doesn't particularly interest me. It's not something I've ever aspired to or thought, wouldn't it be fantastic? I didn't, I remember being struck as a child by the moon landing, etc. But it doesn't, I think for somebody who it has been their ambition all their life, I just find it a challenge to think of where in a world of scarce resources and plenty to spend significant money on, that this is where the money is being spent. And I find it a struggle to think that given what we need to do to improve our environment, this is the focus of these groups of people. So I'm ambivalent, but it doesn't impress me particularly, or it doesn't really give me any sort of sense of achievement as a civilization. There are lots of things that I think we could be doing as a civilization which would provide me with a much greater sense of purpose.
Well, the panel is Emmeline Part-Dahlstrom from Spacebase. And Emmeline, this text came through, heard the hype on the radio, was dismayed that no reporter challenged the whole idea of space tourism against the backdrop of climate crisis. Surely with all the fuel involved, space tourism is the worst thing we can do. That's from Paul. What's your response to that?
Yeah, so I think one thing to note, though, is that definitely, I mean, it's not zero emissions to go up in space. So there is for sure that impact on the environment. But also one thing to think about is that, you know, the equivalent of one Falcon 9 launch today, which is sort of like what happened today, is the equivalent of just one jumbo jet that's flying, you know, across, let's say, the Pacific or the Atlantic. And to think that there's about, you know, just in New Zealand alone, pre-COVID, there's about 100 international flights that go a day. So just like think about, you know, think about the difference of that. So I think because space launches are, you know, very visual and they're sort of like hyped out, we always think that they are really, really big, like emitters of emissions compared to the current, like basically air industry that we need to sort of like find the solutions for.
Thank you, Emmeline. Thanks for joining us on the panel.
Thank you.
Emmeline Part-Dahlstrom from Spacebase. And Warren from Nelson says, if someone said good luck to me when I was strapping into a rocket, I think I'd unstrap and run away.
you want a little bit more than luck. You want some precision and maybe some science, some good engineering. But luck you don't really want.
No. Would you be brave enough, either of you, to get in there?
If I were younger, I mean, I've always had dreams about, everybody surely somewhere in their mind has dreams about going to space. And if I was much younger, I think, and I'd like to think that future generations will be able to travel to space and that it will bring the benefits that we all hope for the future. But not me. Well, no, I think my boat has sailed.
I'd want to. So if it was, if you could get on your gold card one trip to space, you'd turn it down?
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I'm definitely. If my gold card got me a free trip into space, I would take it in an instant.
Oh, okay. I don't know. My view of the world is just too narrow. I can't see the point of it. They speak at times, don't they, of discovering alloys and making significant scientific benefit, you know, advances, which end up having value to us across a range of attributions. But yeah, it just doesn't do anything for me. And I think we could be doing so much more to fix the problems we've got rather than going and looking for somewhere else to make a problem.
Peter texts to say, interesting comment about private space race. Prominent scientists are enthusiastic because they see huge benefits and they're always struggle for funding. These ventures have provided very valuable information. Tall poppy syndrome, alive and well. That's from Peter.
Well, I'm happy to be corrected then if there are real and tangible benefits, you know, for the science community as well as people. And I'm probably just carrying my tired old biases with me.
No comment. Right. Just thinking 65. How old are you? It's not that old these days, is it, Ella?
No, but, you know, I mean, clearly somebody sees merit in something that I don't, and I'm quite happy to accept that my view is I don't expect other people to have my view. It's just my view.
And that's why the panel exists. It's 13 minutes to five. And while a change to drug laws has led to a significant drop in people being charged for drug use and possession, it's been claimed that Māori are now even more likely to be charged than non-Māori. Well, that's according to an article by Derek Cheng in the New Zealand Herald. A 2019 law change clarified that police should not prosecute for drug use if a therapeutic approach was more beneficial for the public interest. Well, with me now is Drug Foundation Executive Director Sarah Helm. Kia ora, Sarah.
Oh, kia ora. How are you?
Can you give us an overview of what Derek has revealed here in the NZ Herald?
Yeah, so talk about old biases. Basically, it says that there's been inconsistent application of the law depending on whether you're Māori or non-Māori and depending on where you live. So that law change that you referenced to left a bit of scope, so it's a discretion for the police and it's quite subject to interpretation. And the research that Derek has done through OIAs has shown that the gap between Māori and non-Māori has gotten worse since this amendment. So Māori are now 41% more likely to be charged for drug use or possession than non-Māori. So essentially non-Māori, it's gone from 20 to 8 versus 24 to 15% of Māori picked up for use or possession that are being charged. So yeah, it's quite a serious discrepancy.
Well, the police have responded. They say it's all to do with prior offending and whether people get charged or not. That's what they've said. They haven't provided any data yet.
Yeah, so, you know, I would say let's show us the evidence then. And I expect as an institution who is trying to address your unconscious bias, it would be good to be really upfront and transparent. But however, or moreover, the main point is how on earth do further convictions help these people? So what difference do they make? We're talking about possession and use charges, and really these charges, the people who are only hurting themselves by the activity. The Minister of Health clearly stated after the election that he insisted that this amendment was to be applied where it was the highest charge, not where it was the only ever charge. So it's quite an interpretation in and of itself. I think we're compounding the harms on those who are most harmed, and the law is very unclear at this point. Let's provide some compassion.
There's a breakdown for a regional breakdown as well in regard to where this alleged racism is greater.
That's right. I mean, I'm nervous to draw complete conclusions because it could be that there are different ways of recording the data at a local level. Like, for example, if a police person observes somebody and chooses not to interact with them, that's, I think, usually not recorded. And so it could be that it's slightly different to those to what the stats are showing. But nonetheless, it shows some real inconsistency in the application of this clause. And the clause itself sort of lends itself towards inconsistent application, even though it was really well intended.
The clause of applying discretion.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it gives the permission to apply discretion. And so, you know, I think that one of the things that we would say is that really it's up to the Parliament to determine the law, not the police. The police are there to implement the law. And so, you know, it's probably time for the government to really set the law. And this has traditionally been a bit of a political hot potato, and so perhaps nerves are getting in the way of doing what needs to be done. But the truth is, for a long time, we've had a vast majority of voters that support decriminalisation, and let's formally make the move towards that.
But they didn't in the election referendum.
The election referendum was actually on legalisation, which is a different thing. It's another step where you have legal provision of the substance versus not prosecuting people for use or possession, which is what we're talking about here. Even, I think it was 39% of people, so a survey came out earlier this year, 39% of the people who voted no against that referendum support this lesser move of decriminalisation, if you like.
So what is going on when the police tell us that they're doing a lot of work internally in regard to unconscious bias?
I mean, I think that, you know, I think, and your panellists may have some views on that, but I think it's a great thing that they've named that and that they're working on it. I think the problem is this particular clause literally gives permission to the police to apply their discretion, and where the discretion is racially biased or is informed by some other kind of bias or has a regional sort of differentiation of how that area, whatever the official terms are in the police, have chosen to interpret the law, then you've got this regional variance, and that's not how the law should be. It should be clear to me whether or not I'm going to use a substance, whether or not I'm going to be prosecuted for it if I'm caught, and that shouldn't be different based on where I live or the colour of my skin.
Michael, do you think the police can be trusted to apply discretion?
Well, I think that I don't know that part of the part of the context for this is that for them to say that it isn't that they're biased, it's that past convictions are the indicator of this. If that's the case, then they're not showing discretion. They're using criteria, in which case that's not right. That's not what they've been asked to do. If they're genuinely showing discretion, then you wouldn't expect, because I agree with Sarah, basically, it's governments, it's politicians' job to set the criteria. I think it's really hard for police to show genuine discretion and to do that with any consistency. Otherwise, you do get inconsistencies around regions or people's bias or any other number of things. I just don't think it's fair to ask the police to do it. I think it's unreasonable.
Ella?
Because I think no matter what, there's a really good chance there will be bias here.
Yeah, Ella?
I mean, I've been monitoring, you know, this whole situation around police, accusations of police racism and organisational structural bias for for decades. There was a report came out in 98, which, you know, clearly showed many police had different perceptions of Māori. So that's one issue, and I really applaud the hierarchy of the police trying to address those kinds of unconscious biases with training and preparation and clear guidelines. But the other thing to remember is that whilst it looks like Māori are more likely to be charged, we still have a situation where Māori are more likely to be stopped. And Māori are more likely to have previous convictions for non-drug things like the work that Mike Williams does in prisons, where he's found a significant number of Māori and Pacifica men in prison are there because of traffic offences, because they don't have driver's licences, because they don't have the literacy to pass the test. They can drive, they just don't have a driver's licence. And he's ameliorated that with that programme of, you know, getting men who leave jail with licences. So if your previous conviction is traffic, then they're more likely to search your car and, oh, golly gosh, they're more likely to stop you and, you know. So it's a vicious cycle that I do think it is important we address with training, but we also look at some of those bigger social issues around how it is that Māori men are more likely to have those early convictions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sarah, the good news, I guess, is that there's a significant drop in people being charged for drug use and possession.
Yeah, I mean, we should celebrate that, and I mean to be positive about it. Nonetheless, we still have 18% of people being picked up and convicted for drug use or possession charges. I mean, I would have thought that most people would find that pretty ludicrous. It not only is potentially criminalising people for a crime where they're hurting only themselves, but also it does a whole lot of other things. It puts, you know, it changes your life course when you get a conviction. So it's mostly young people and Māori who are impacted by this. And also it drives drug use into the shadows. And so people don't seek help when they need it. They don't talk to their doctor about it. They don't talk to their loved ones about it. And we think that's one of the really big problems around our drug laws at the moment.
Jess has got a text for you. Sarah says, your guest said drug users only hurt themselves. That's a simplistic outlook. Family violence, trauma on the roads through impaired drivers, neglected and abused children. Open your eyes, all you drug liberals. Regards, Jess.
Yes, sorry, I don't mean to belittle that. What we're talking about here is people that have been with the highest charge is drug use. So that's who we're talking about here. They haven't been found to have done anything else wrong.
Thank you.
It's worrying that the assumption automatically is that anybody who's been charged with drugs is automatically some kind of, you know, monster in terms of domestic violence or other kinds of acts of violence. And I'm not sure that there's the statistical evidence to back up that view. Yeah,
well, not all drugs are equal, are they? You know, all drugs are equal.
No. Also, I'm not convinced that driving something underground by having laws the way they are is very inducive for people to get help if they do have the problems which that text has suggested. It doesn't help that we won't talk about it or that we won't, as Sarah suggests, go and seek the support that's needed to change that behaviour. So I don't know how the current situation makes it better, as it were.
Sarah, thanks for coming on and joining us this afternoon on the panel.
No worries. Thank you so much.
That's Sarah Helm, Drug Foundation Executive Director. We've got a minute away from going towards the news. It's actually 2 minutes to five, but we've got a minute left. And so that's just about it from us. My thanks to Dr. Ella Henry. Kia ora. Thank you very much, Ella.
No, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
A great afternoon. And Michael Moynihan, you're in Auckland, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
I've got a thing that says that you're in Wellington, but you mentioned your neighbourhood Facebook group.
Yeah, we live some of the time in Wellington, some of the time in Auckland, but when we live here in Auckland, we live in Nuneahunga, and I really enjoy it. God, it's been hot here today for anybody that's been interested in Auckland weather.
That's a plus. Thank you very much, and thanks to producer Emma Hurley. Ka hoki mai a popo. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you very much for joining us and for all your texts and feedback. Really, really appreciate it. And Lisa Owen with Checkpoint is next.